Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:38 p.m., and that is Central Time. Today is December 23rd, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I'm recording a little earlier than normal because I've got some Christmas shopping that I need to go out and do, and I'd like to get it done before it gets dark because it's currently minus 11 degrees Celsius outside, and I think there's probably the risk of ice on the roads. So, as we head into the end of 2022, let's just think for a moment about what are the big questions for 2023. And I really think that there's really only one. And it's how willing are central banks going to be to persist in the pattern of behavior that developed in response to the global financial crisis in 2008. Because we've had a profound move higher in bond prices for the last 40 years, and 2022 delivered a really significant decline in terms of total return. The number of times where both bonds and equities have trended downwards in tandem in a given year is frighteningly small. So we don't have a lot of precedent for these kinds of moves. And it, of course, then begs the big question: are we going to see continued advances in the willingness of central banks to multiply the size of their balance sheets? Or are they going to be much less willing to do that in future? So it's impossible to answer that question because we don't know what they're going to do in the face of a clear crisis. Because certainly we've had an uptick in inflation this year, and inflation in response to massive money printing has resulted in bond prices coming down, the total return on bonds dropping and breaking its uptrend for the first time in 40 years. So this is a really significant event, and it could potentially be the end of a secular bull market in bonds. We had certainly a willingness to indulge in modern monetary theory in response to the pandemic. There was And we have to think about that in terms of investor psychology. When we think about how do trends evolve and how do manias occur, well, we can think about it in simple terms, that a trend will keep going on for as long as it takes for supply to overwhelm demand. And a long-term trend changes the fundamentals of the market. This is one of the most important topics that I think we talk about at the chart seminar, but I think it's most important at the major turns in the market. Because bond yields compressed for decades, there were fortunes made by buying the dip, and there was a whole suite of government policies predicated on the expectation that yields would persist in going lower indefinitely. And then, of course, we got to zero. And in terms of interest rates, we had a massive quantity of bonds that had negative yields. And that was 17 trillion at one point, and now it's less than 2 trillion. So Japan, even in here this week, decided that they were going to abandon their willingness to suppress yields of the 10-year at a quarter of 1%, and they're now going to defend half of 1%. So JGB yields popped on the upside. That's going to smooth out the belly in the yield curve that's been in evidence for most of the last couple of years. And we can see there it's quite clear that there's this belly in the curve around the 10-year, and it's already starting to erode. So those yields are pushing higher. Although it's over the last week, it's actually been the 8 and the 9-year have moved more. So that has at least demonstrated that even now, investors are still not quite willing to believe that we're at the end of the quantitative easing program. But let's just think about how those fundamentals change in response to a long-term trend. So, first, when we think about the bond markets, with this expectation of yields going down forever, then pension promises have increased, and large numbers of people now expect to be able to retire at 50, 55, or 60. And lots of teachers, police, firemen, or fire people, although I think it's often police and mostly firemen, but the reality is that they're now expecting to retire after 30 years of service. And they expect to be able to retire with a big in percentages of their final salary. And that's all been contributory in terms of the expectation that yields would persist lower indefinitely, that the cost of borrowing money would never become problematic. But if that trend ever ends, then the ability to meet those obligations is going to be really problematic. So we've already seen, for example, that in China this year, they've increased the retirement age. There was this big disparity in China between the ages at which women and men could retire, and it was almost 10 years in the difference. So now they're starting to raise the retirement age for more people. That's a direct response to demographic change. And of course, demographics are another very important factor in terms of interest rates. So when you have an elderly population and fewer young people in the population, well, then that should help to suppress yields over the longer term. But when governments are printing money to meet their obligations and spending programs are increasing relative to productive capacity, well, then that's where inflation starts to come in. And we've certainly seen that central banks are alert to the risks. So they're raising rates to try and get this under control now, and one might argue belatedly. And they're talking tough. And the Bank of England is a very good example of this talking tough because they don't have much choice. So the 10-year gilt is sitting here at about 3.6%. We had a meaningful contraction in response to the Bank of England's efforts to support the pension industry because they had been engaged in rather naughty behavior, because they're not supposed to be engaged in leverage, but that's exactly what they were doing. And they were leveraging up their exposure to short-term rates. When rates went up, then they really got caught in the hop. And the Bank of England had to intervene, and the pension industry lost somewhere in the region of between 100 and 150 billion in the space of about 3 weeks. Now yields are starting to push back up again. And the big questions outstanding are going to be about the level of spending. How quickly is spending eventually going to be curtailed? Most of the budget measures that have been implemented so far have been about cutting back, mostly about increasing taxes. And a lot of the spending cuts have been delayed until after the next election. But yields rising now again Well, that's going to bring the topic of spending back to the fore. And of course, the public perception of the reliability of the Conservative Party to be careful custodians of the economy has been severely damaged. And there's obviously then the real potential that there will be electoral change at the next election, and that you'll get a Labour government. And Labour's manifesto is very similar to the Conservatives, but they will be expected to spend more money. Now we can also think about what's happening in Brazil, where you've already have a leftist government has been elected, and you have some of the largest real positive real interest rates in the world, where the overnight rate is 13.65% and the inflation rate is down below 6% now. So there's over a 7% real yield in Brazil. And the central bank is not willing to declare victory over inflation because they're worried that if they were to declare a victory, then that would give license to the new government to go off and spend a ton of money. So there's certainly a reticence among central banks to indulge politicians. And this is true in most countries now. But we can say that because we're still not in a recession. And a recession is coming. And that's something that we need to pay attention to in 2023. So the yield curve spread, this is the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year, is at negative 57 basis points. And it's at lows that we haven't seen in decades. So it's at the deepest inversion that we've seen since the Volcker period in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So central banks are certainly attempting to curtail financial conditions. Now we can also look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, and sorry, that is the 10-year minus. And let me just make sure that I'm putting up the right chart. The 10-year minus the 3-month is in the region of negative 54 basis points, back in the region of the lows from 2000 and 2006. So this kind of contraction is meaningful. Then we can also look at a more technical way of thinking about it, which would be the 18-month swap rate in 3 months, taken then with the 3-month yield subtracted from it, which is the Fed's preferred way of measuring the yield curve, and that's also at a sharply inverted condition. One thing that I would hasten to add is that we had a rather deep contraction in this yield curve in 2019 as well. And I think this is wholly overlooked by investors, that it was really very likely that we were going to have a recession in 2020, in 2019. We had an inverted yield curve. We had egregiously valued private assets. And there was a whole range of new IPOs. So we'd seen an increase in supply of new stock, and lots of the companies, these unicorn companies that had been staying private for longer than was normal, well, a lot of them listed in late 2018 and 2019. One of the big ones was Uber. And then we also had the Vision Fund created as well by SoftBank. So that was one of the biggest funds ever, $100 billion. And that was considered back then a lot of money. And then, of course, we had trillions spent in response to the pandemic. So what that contributed to was this huge amount of money being printed, and an even larger valuation attached to private assets. And I do think that there are similarities between what happened in 1998 and the NASDAQ and what's happened with the pandemic and private assets. So we can think about the fact that the NASDAQ in 1998 was trading at the lows around about 1150. And by the peak, it had gone up to well in excess of 4,000. So we had the Russian debt default, and then long-term capital management went bust. And stocks, which had been going up for a long time and were already looking fully valued, they pulled back. And then the Federal Reserve did a whip around and rescued the banking sector. And they demurred from raising interest rates. And they held off for another year. Then there were fears about Y2K. And there was a slew of additional new orders, which pulled forward orders from the future. And the technology sector went wild. And we had this huge advance. Well, we had a similar event in terms of pulling forward sales from the future in during the pandemic. And that was most especially true of the semiconductor sector, where everybody went out and bought a new phone and a new tablet and a new laptop. So we've had not only panic about a loss of access to available components. We've had geopolitical panic as well, that China could invade Taiwan any day, cut off the global supply chain, and that would create a significant problem. So we have now got manufacturing nationalism starting to come through. So there are significant investments going on all over the world to build semiconductor And the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index is trending lower. It's pricing in the very real potential that the world is going to be flooded with semiconductor supply within the next 2 years. And ASML has got an enviable order book that stretches out for the next few years. And yet we had a big downside weekly Q reversal last week, and then it followed through on the downside this week. So this is a pretty significant failed upside break. And I do want to draw your attention to the fact that the low occurred in October. Now, I created this chart at a while back, and it's a measure of global financial conditions. And what I want to mostly point out are two things. There's this tendency to think that private assets are immune to the financial cycle, and people tend to look at the experience of 2020 and say, well, that was a big test for private assets, and they passed. That we didn't have a big jump in defaults, and therefore the risk in this sector is relatively well understood and contained. When we look at global financial conditions, the spike that we had in 2020 was reasonably similar to what we had in 2015 and 16 and in 2011. So I think the only real way to think about this is as a blip or a hiccup, or at the very least, a medium-term correction. Then we can see that we had this big pop on the upside in October and it peaked. So we had a peak in global financial tightness. Condition tightness in October, and a meaningful reversion to the mean. And that contributed to a really quite substantial rebound. And now global financial conditions are tightening again, bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. There's been a clear sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of 2022, and that's still intact. If we see this index going up through 100, then that's going to represent a really significant or a meaningful tightening of global financial conditions, which will weigh on stock prices. So as we think about what to expect in 2023, then we know that not only are yield curve spreads inverted, which is a reliable lead indicator for future trouble, but that central banks are actively tightening financial conditions as well, and that there's a clear uptrend to that tightening. So they're going to get even tighter. And they want to kill off inflation because the cost of servicing the debt is rising. And the higher it goes, the more difficult it is to sustain living standards. And the more difficult it is for governments to really get control over borrowing costs. And it's when servicing the debt becomes problematic that then big cuts, necessary cuts, and cuts that can't be avoided start to come through in terms of public services. So that's obviously something that every country wants to try and avoid, which means they really do want to try and kill off inflation. And that's what's going on right now. Now, there's the possibility that the Federal Reserve is approaching the end of its tightening cycle. And the market is beginning to price that in. Now, the dollar has pulled back in a violent manner over the course of the last 3 months. And it's now steadying in the region of the upper side of the underlying range and the 200-day moving average. It's below the 200-day moving average, but steadying in the region of it. If the Federal Reserve is actually close to its the peak of the hiking cycle, well then, it's likely the dollar will break lower. But what I suspect instead is we're going to have more rangy action over the next few months, because everywhere else is experiencing a recession as well. And China is going through its pandemic scare. One thing that I'm writing about today is that there are estimates that China is experiencing 3.7 million new cases a day. And then some official statistics out of China are that it's 37 million cases a day. So China has a population of about 1.3 billion. If it were 3.7 million cases a day, then that's about a year to cover the entire population. If it's 37 million, well, then it's going to be done in about a month. So now that they've abandoned the COVID zero policy, then they have a clear vested interest to try and convince people that the worst is over already, and that the entire panicky environment with rising numbers of cases and an overloaded healthcare system will probably be over within the month. Well, one thing that we know from the rest of the world is that it takes about 10 weeks to hit the peak infectivity rate, because and then, of course, that makes sense. The rate accelerates until you run out of easy access to new people to infect. So then, as the number of people who've already been infected goes up and immunity in the wider population improves, then finding the next bunch of uninfected people that don't have any immunity is going to be harder, and therefore the growth rate slows down and the impact on the economy moderates. So it's reasonable to anticipate that we're looking at some point in probably the end of January when the peak occurs. And that would suggest that the Chinese markets are probably not all that far away from a bottom. And there's a lot of fiscal measures have been implemented over the course of the last month, and really since August of this year, to support the economy. So the H-share index is steady here in the region of the 200-day moving average, and so far holding a sequence of higher reaction lows from that low in November. And China's economy stabilizing, then that's going to be problematic in terms of global inflation. So oil prices were stronger again in here today and pulling away from the $80 level. One thing that is also, I think, rather important is the USA is now an energy exporter. And they have a clear vested interest in ensuring that prices do not fall and don't go all the way back down to where they were in the latter part of 2020 or even in 2016. And the US government is now buying for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So that's putting a floor under the market. And China's economy is going to go through a great deal of stress over the course of the next 6 weeks. But there's a lot of fiscal measures have been implemented, and this is exactly what we saw everywhere else. They're doing exactly what everyone else has done. They're going to print money to deal with this issue, and that's going to represent additional new commodity demand. So copper prices have also steadied. Now, this is obviously going to be an issue for global central banks. One of the mitigating factors in terms of inflation in 2022 was China's lackluster growth. But if they are now stimulating, and there's the prospect that they're going to come out of their pandemic panic period at some point in February, then that's something that could easily contribute to excessive inflationary pressures again. I'll come back to the initial question. How likely is it that central banks are going to do what they've done in the past? Are they sufficiently chastened by inflation that they're not going to print money? So let's just look at the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, because there are a couple of important points. The first is that every time they try to take money out, they end up having to increase the size of the balance sheet by a double. So the size of the balance sheet in 2008 went from about $1 trillion to over $2 trillion. And then they tried to moderate the size of it, and subsequently it went from about 2.25 to about 4.5. They tried quantitative tightening and they took 750 billion out, and then the size of the Fed's balance sheet doubled. So it peaked earlier this year, let's call it 9 trillion. We're at more or less 8.5 trillion now. So they've taken not quite 500 billion out of circulation, but not far off it either. So the size of the quantitative tightening program is already approaching that of the 2018 to 2019 period. And we also have evidence of what happened with the ECB. So I think these are certainly important points that on at least the last three occasions, whenever a central bank has tried to take supply out of the market, they've had to multiply the size of the balance sheet subsequently. So they're in a period of quantitative tightening right now. Then the question is going to be, what are they going to do when deflationary pressures start to arise? So we have rising commodity prices that are going to contribute to inflation and lower living standards if China's economy starts to open up and demand for commodities continues. Then that is going to inhibit central banks from cutting interest rates. It will put additional pressure on the private asset sector. And I think that when we think about where the epicenter of risk is, then it's in the private asset sector. So this, I think, is where the real evidence of fundamentals changing in response to a long-term trend is most obvious, that private assets have ballooned in value. Demand for private assets has gone up, even though the price of these assets has been falling in 2022. The revenue or the investments in the sector have increased in 2022. So it's not like we're seeing allocations to private assets starting to change. It's quite the opposite, that investors are still putting money in, even though prices are starting to moderate. And that is on the assumption that interest rates are not going up, or they're not going to stay up, that they're going to come straight back down again. And I think this is the very clear challenge that central banks are dealing with, that the investment community believes that central banks don't have the appetite or the ability or the willingness to continue to raise interest rates and do what is necessary to kill inflation. And since that's the case, then investors continue to put money into private assets. And the primary reason that private assets were so attractive was because they offered competitive yields in a very low yield environment. But bond yields are moving higher now. So the higher the discount rate, then the more the expected return has to be from a private asset to make it attractive enough. We've also seen that covenant light lending has proliferated over the last decade simply because investors were desperate for yield and were willing to take any kinds of conditions in order to capture that yield. The higher and longer interest rates stay and go, then the more likely it is that asset prices are going to come under pressure and that businesses are going to experience stress. We have not yet seen earnings rolling over, but consumers are starting to experience stress. So, to me, anyway, I look at this chart of Costco, and Costco has been one of the most rewarding shares over the last decade. And coming from a low back in 2009 of 32, it was at 600 at the peak back in April of this year, and now it looks like a top formation. So it's steadying in the region of the lows, but it's got an awful lot of work to do in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And then I think Lululemon is another really interesting example, because the share has gone up incredibly impressively. So it was trading at about a low, somewhere around $6 back in 2009, and it's around 300 now. This is a really strong example of a head and shoulders pattern or a type 3 top. Relative to the advance, the size of the range is extraordinary, from 300 to 500, and now coming back down. So Lululemon is a great example where it's a company that sells really expensive sports gear. And people will pay for it because they have available cash. But affording this kind of apparel is very dependent on abundant consumer credit or cash. So when it breaks down, I think it is going to be a reasonable barometer for the consumer really rolling over. And it looks like a really significant type 3 top formation, which suggests that when it goes, then $100 or less is going to be a reasonable target. So these are, I think, where we can anticipate that there's going to be issues, that we're looking at the potential for a significant contraction in asset prices in 2023 in response to persistent inflationary pressures. And the bond yield, then, we can just look at this longer term chart where it's still trending higher and it was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. And bond investors are looking at the potential that commodity price inflation is going to start to become problematic. And we have clearly broken the long-term sequence of lower rally highs. So this is a meaningful break of trend. Now let's also pay attention to the fact that the energy sector has been among the best performers for 2 years in a row. And if we look at the S&P 500 for this year, then it's companies like Meta and Tesla have been among the worst performers, and PayPal for that matter, and the best performers have all been attached to the energy sector, and only one of those is a renewable energy company. So we're definitely seeing more money flowing into commodity investments. And then we can think about some individual shares where, for example, Shell is firming now from the region of the 200-day moving average, and Petrobras, which has fallen precipitously because of a threat to its higher dividend, was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. But one thing that's important to highlight is that the resources sector tends to do best in the latter stages of an economic expansion. So BHP Billiton is back in the region of its peaks, and it's above where it was trading back in 2010 and 11. There's obviously this big question about the willingness of investors to, well, let's not just talk about willingness. It's the willingness of everybody to have more mines around the world. And there's this big bullish question that we're going to have to double the supply of copper to meet the global demand for electric vehicles. And how on earth are we going to have a doubling in the supply of copper when nobody wants a new mine in their back door or in their backyard? So I do think that there's a mismatch between the bullish prognostications about the ultimate demand for electric vehicles and how that's actually going to be realized. Maybe it's going to be with a revolutionary new battery chemistry, but doesn't exist yet. And we definitely see that these commodity prices are rising, and nickel prices are also trending higher, and lithium prices are still really very firm. So it's not like investors aren't willing to give the benefit of the doubt in the short term. But it also means that the cost of batteries went up this year. And that's the first time that the cost of batteries has gone up for about a decade. So maybe we're at the bottom. Maybe this is as low a price for batteries as can be achieved because the cost of those commodities is continuing to go up. Well, that also suggests that the sector is rather susceptible to a fall off in demand, and that when earnings do roll over in response to tightening financial conditions, then that's going to have an impact on the wider market for these resources. Usually, it's when we get this period where tightening financial conditions have not yet fed through into the wider economy that demand for resources is most robust. Now, the dirty tanker index is trending downwards. Now, it does tend to be exceptionally volatile, and we do get a lot of cyclicality in terms of the moves, but it is starting to come back down, and that suggests that there's less demand for oil tankers. So I'm very suspicious of the continued strength of the resources sector, just simply because I am anticipating that global growth is going to take a hit in 2023. Now, we're betting then that China's demand is going to not only support the commodity complex, but support the entire global economy, and that central banks are going to ignore the inflationary pressures from rising commodity prices and relent from raising interest rates. And I think that those are not they're not complementary themes. You can't have it both ways. Well, that suggests then that interest rates might stay higher for longer. Financial conditions might grow even tighter, and then that will put downward pressure on a lot of these stocks. And the Nasdaq is pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average. We had the downside weekly key reversal last week, and we had downside follow through in here this week. Now, prices today are pretty stable, but we've definitely seen that some of the companies, even those that have fallen most already, they haven't really been able to rally in a dynamic manner. And Meta Platforms, I suspect, is not all that far away from its low. But then the question is, how likely is it to go back up to 400? And that's the big question, that after a big decline like this, we could go through a very lengthy period of consolidation. So we're likely to see a recession in 2023 and early, or I guess, or early 2024. And then we'll see a meaningful contraction in asset prices. Then we'll see what kind of themes will evolve out of that. It seems particularly likely that there's going to have to be rearmament. And when we think about the defense sector, the sheer volume of armaments that are being expended in Ukraine on a daily basis means that manufacturing capacity is going to have to go up and go up significantly. And that's a lot of metal, and it's a lot of mining, and it's a lot of fabrication. So it's also a lot of government sponsorship. there will be additional demand for renewable energy, but not necessarily on a climate change basis, although it will certainly be framed in those terms, but perhaps more in terms of just national security. And that makes a lot more sense in terms of allocating assets. So European support for carbon trading isn't going to disappear, and carbon credits continue to firm within their range. And I kind of think of carbon credits in almost like a bond proxy, because when the price goes down, they will remove supply to support it. There are government-mandated efforts to try and support prices, and they want the price to go up to about 130. So that suggests that there's at least another 40 euro that it can rise, which isn't far off a 50% return. And that's a government-mandated return. So I think this is an example of what we should expect, that we're going to see greater control over capital from governments because central banks are inhibiting liquidity. And the expected return from investments is going to have competition from a discount rate. So then, in order to encourage investment, then you need some kind of guarantee. And government support would certainly be a would qualify for that. We're likely to see additional investment in utilities, energy infrastructure, aerospace, defense, and all of those on national security grounds. Then there's the potential that we'll see a reorientation of global manufacturing. And a good part of the reason for that is because China is running out of young workers, and particularly young workers who are willing to work in factories. So China's moving up the value chain, which is basically leaving a big part of the value chain available for other countries. So India trades at a higher valuation, and it is historically and will remain a volatile market. So the Nifty index was down in a dynamic manner in here this week, and it's not going to be immune from tightening global financial conditions. So the best time to buy India is when it's had big shakeouts. And potentially, if it follows through on the downside next week, this is a failed upside break. So we need to be alert to the potential that India is going to experience a deeper correction over the course of the next few months, which will help to set up the next significant buying opportunity. Countries like Brazil are likely to benefit because they supply the resources that investment that countries need in order to boost their own investment credentials, but then also for their national priorities. So the Bovespa index is firming from the 100,000 level and doing so in a reasonably dynamic manner. And it's been ranging for most of the last 2 years in nominal terms. But the real has been steadying over the last couple of years. So if we just redenominate the index into dollars, well, then we can see that the range has been going onwards now for really the last 7 years. And it looks a lot more like a base formation overall. So there's certainly the potential that Brazil will do better as we look at a longer term period of global power competition. So there's certainly a lot riding on the question of what happens with inflation, global power competition, and then the willingness of central banks to inflate their balance sheets. Now, when it comes to national security over inflation, national security will always win out. So there will be more money made available for rearmament and domestic infrastructure on the grounds that it is a that infrastructure in particular is a productive asset. But will central banks be willing to inflate their balance sheets as aggressively in future? I think this is going to be most particularly a question for Bitcoin. So Bitcoin tends to do exceptionally well during these periods of outsized money creation. And it did exactly that in 2017 with the fiscal stimulus, Trump's fiscal stimulus. And then it did it again in 2020, 21 because of the pandemic stimulus. And in between, it goes through these exceptionally deep corrections. And we're seeing another one right now. But there is a cyclicality to Bitcoin because of the halving. And the next one will be in April of 24. And after the halvings, they have tended to coincide with bouts of significant money printing that have helped to support prices. So, definitely, Bitcoin is no longer as consistent as it used to be. It has pulled back below the 1,000-day moving average. The 200-day moving average is pushing down through the 1,000-day moving average. The price has pulled back below a bull market peak for the first time. So a lot of the consistency characteristics that were present in the longer-term trend are no longer evident. So this is, I think, raising the important question that if Bitcoin's consistency is breaking down, and it was the asset that was most sensitive to money printing, then doesn't that imply that we are no longer in the same trend of money printing that has been in evidence since 2008? And that interest rates will stay higher for longer? That when they do cut, they will not go to zero? And when they do print, they may not print as much as they have before. Now, it doesn't mean that they won't cut interest rates or they won't print money. They will. And we'll have a rebound in asset prices. But the focus of attention is going to more likely be on how much money is printed and how low interest rates go. And we could see a short covering rally in a lot of the technology-oriented sectors, particularly those loss-making companies. But that if we don't see the same volume of money being printed, then they're not going to go up as much as they had in the past, and they will subsequently fall more. And that those that survive will go into type 3 bottoming characteristics to inform long-term basis. And a good number will go bust. And that new trends will evolve. So the new trends are going to be more reliant on cash flow. And there'll be the kinds of assets that should do well when there is a discount rate, which means that there will be value opportunities and quality will outperform growth. I posted a number of charts in Comment of the Day on Thursday, highlighting the fact that the incredible performance of the Fangman companies that it allowed them to be categorized as both quality and growth. And because they're now underperforming, then it means that some of the quality, particularly those that focused on the big technology companies are underperforming. Then the ESG sector, because a lot of the technology companies don't have a lot of emissions, so they got categorized as ESG. So those ESG funds are underperforming. And then, of course, they're categorized as high growth companies. So those growth assets are underperforming because the eight big companies, they represented in excess of 22% of the total market cap of the entire market at the beginning of the year, and it's at 17% now. So they've lost 5% of the total market cap of the entire market in just 1 year. And Amazon has the dubious record now of being the first company to lose $1 trillion in market cap. And the share steadied a little in here today, but is still in a downtrend overall. So this, I think, is a change of the guard in terms of these large companies. They're not going to be the best performers in the next big bull market. There will be new champions, but they're going to be companies that have got strong cash flows and are capable of growing in a less liquidity abundant environment. I do think that biotechnology is going to be particularly meaningful, and we will see more applications of big data and artificial intelligence, and we'll see productivity enhancements because they'll be necessary in a higher, less liquid environment. Generally, commodities should do well in that environment, but they will remain volatile, and we could be in a tight liquidity environment and a tight supply environment, which would necessitate higher commodity prices to encourage new supply into the market. And of course, if we are going to be looking at lower growth overall and pressures on government finances, then gold should do well. Now, gold prices rebounded sharply over the last few months in response to the lower dollar. And when earnings do roll over and we move into a recessionary environment, and the big questions start to be raised about the ability of governments to hold or to fund themselves in an environment where interest rates don't go down as much as they have in the past, well, then that's when gold will become more attractive because the kinds of sacrifices that are going to be required in terms of government spending aren't going to be welcomed by consumers. So there is the real possibility that we're seeing, or we're going to see, a big mismatch between what central banks want to do and what governments want to do. And I do think that paying attention to what happens in places like Brazil and the UK are going to give us case studies for what we can expect in other countries. And the fact that gold has pushed back above the 200-day moving average, it suggests that we're going to see less faith in fiat currencies. And the big challenge, of course, is going to be that when governments take over control of spending, they can allocate capital, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be allocated in the best way. And this is most particularly true as we look at less efficient ways of producing energy. And that's just going to increase the cost of everything, which is going to make economies less efficient. And therefore, we shouldn't anticipate that currencies will certainly appreciate in value. And That's also positive for gold over the medium term. But in the short term, gold doesn't particularly do well in a recession, and it tends to rally really impressively after the recessionary pullback, but generally not during. And I think that's equally true of the Dividend Aristocrats, which I think are the epitome of quality. So they're hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average and have held up much better than the growth sector over the last year. Now, they're not going to be immune from a recession, but they do bounce back faster. And it's when quality can be redenominated as value that it becomes truly attractive. And that's generally the best time to buy. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and I guess for 2022. And I'd like to wish everyone a very happy and peaceful Christmas and holiday. And I look forward to a prosperous 2023.